get stuck between these two pieces. But I was able to wiggle through. Now, that was 21 years ago, maybe. Mm-hmm. I'm a tad heavier.
My body lifts 5 pounds.
Then. Okay, I'm a lot heavier than. And so that same phrase crops up all the time. And so we did a raising last week, and there were some stick frame walls that were on the job. Well, they're 16 inches on center, right? And so mm-hmm. I go slipping between the 16-inch center studs. And, you know, it's a good thing that 2x4s bend. and so as I'm bowling my way through, I hear one of my guys that's still there from way back in the day, "Hey, looks like Superman can still suck it in." I'm like, "Yeah, you're fired. You're fired, buddy." You know?
That's funny.
The Blue Collar Voices Show.
The answer to last week's trivia question is, believe it or not, in this 14-year massive project with almost 400 workers, there were not any fatalities.
That suave comedian, dry humorist, and famous master of ceremonies, Jack Benny.
Thank you, Mr. Thorgerson. That's pretty good from a man who doesn't even know me. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Jack Benny talking and making my first appearance on the air professionally. By that I mean I'm finally getting paid, which of course will be a great relief to my creditors. I really don't know why I'm here. I'm supposed to be a sort of a master of ceremonies and tell you all the things that will happen, which would happen anyway. I must introduce the different artists who could easily introduce themselves and also talk about the Canada Dry made to order by the glass, which is a waste of time, as you know all about it. You drink it, like it, and don't want to hear about it. So, ladies and gentlemen, a master of ceremonies is really a fellow who is unemployed and gets paid for it.
Welcome back to part two with John Van Bruggen. The recording with him was so long, just had to break it up into two parts. All right, let's get to part two.
Because it's always about how much does it cost. Does that answer the question that you were trying to get to?
I think that's a great answer. Have you had anybody that's like, "Look, we have a lot of room to play here. We're not really that worried about cost. I mean, don't get crazy, but let's have what we want."
A few. I used to say that everybody has a budget. Oftentimes they're way bigger than nobody's in my tax bracket. You know, they're mm-hmm. all in other tax brackets. Uh-huh. There has been a few clients that have expressed to me, "I don't care what it is. This is what I want." And I just say, okay. And one of the reasons I think they feel comfortable coming to me is on really big, complicated projects like that, I don't bid the job with a cap. What I do is I say, once we get a frame design so I can actually count pieces and figure out how much wood I got, then I'll say, "Hey, I think I might have, you know, 14 weeks in preparing this frame, 14 weeks in the shop." I said, "But I might be 12 and I might be 16. So I can either cap this at 16 or we could just leave it open-ended and I'm just going to charge you a shop rate. And if we're good at 12, then that's all I'm going to bill you for. I'm not going to bill you for 14 or for 16 if it only takes me 12. And I do that on the big, complicated projects, whether they be residential or commercial. You don't make a whole lot of money doing that, but you do make your rate. Mm-hmm. I mean, so the profit margin is smaller, but you also don't lose your butt on the back end if you go over.
Right.
I like those types of situations. And what I see in my clients' faces is that they trust me, that I'm not lying to them. I'm not going to charge them for 13 weeks if it's only 12. And I have that conversation. It's like, if you can trust me to build this, to make all of this come to life, then you've got to be able to trust me also to bill it correctly. Mm-hmm. And they're in at that point. And I'm completely transparent with it. And so those things, those work out pretty good. I like those bigger projects at times because it blocks off, you know, spaces on the calendar where I can say, okay, spring is gone. So now the new projects coming in, they're summertime, and it helps me build a yearly schedule. If you, mm-hmm. if your yearly schedule was 15 different projects and they were all medium to small and you weren't quite sure where they were going to land, you'll spend a whole lot of time just standing around waiting on something to happen. And so the bigger projects help me schedule everything else.
Mm-hmm. Keep the guys busy. Keep the dead time down.
We have two schedules. We have the schedule of what are we building today? You know, what are the guys making sawdust on today? And then the schedule of when are we going to be at your place to install your frame? So those are two different schedules, and you got to keep both of them active.
When you go out there and you install the frame and you got that beautiful frame there, how much of it winds up being exposed versus I could conceive that you could kind of cover it up all completely and you have a great timber frame, but nobody can tell?
Yeah. So the timbers that are around the perimeter of the building, they are four-sided timbers. And one side of that timber will be covered either with a stick frame wall or with a structural insulated panel. But the other three sides or faces of that timber will be exposed.
Okay.
So when you encapsulate, and I'm using that word on purpose, John. So when you encapsulate the frame, you're not infilling with a wall or with a sit panel, you're encapsulating the frame. So it's like you're taking that timber and you're putting it inside an igloo cooler. So all of that timber is interior to the heating in the air. So the insulation runs past the posts or past the beam or past the rafter. And what that does is it lets the interior frame completely acclimate to the temperature and the relative humidity of the home. If you had a timber that had a cold side or a hot side, so let's say you infilled and there was no insulation behind the post, just plywood ran by it with siding attached to it, that side of the timber that you would never see would always acclimate with the outside, while the other three sides are acclimating with the inside. That timber will never stop moving. Mm-hmm. So you want your frame to get stable at some point. So we use a kiln-dried Doug fir. Kiln-dried in the timber industry means about 19% moisture. It's not like a piece of trim where it's like 6-7% moisture. So with a kiln-dried Doug fir, that takes about two heating seasons for that timber to be done moving. If I use white oak is a green product, which means it hasn't been through a kiln. It takes about seven, eight winters, a heating seasons for it to be done moving. If I have a hot and a cold side to that timber, it'll never stop. Does that make sense?
Makes great sense.
So I told you we go to these trade shows and you have like the round tables that happen at the dinner. And it's interesting to hear other timber framers' perspectives on whether or not your timber should be kiln dried or not. You know, a lot of framers out there in different parts of the country, they never use kiln dried timber. They always use green and they swear by it. The difference is that we live in the Midwest. And so in the Midwest on Monday, it might be 95 degrees, but on Friday, it could be 32. And so we have such huge temperature swings, especially in the spring and in the fall, that you want your timber to be as dry as it can be and to get dry quick and then close it all in and let it acclimate to inside stuff, not the wild temperature swings of a typical Midwest season.
What do you think of this whole niche as a career for somebody?
You know, I have some friends of mine that own other businesses and, you know, we're old grumpy men now. And so we laugh all the time that when young guys ask us, you know, should I start a business? My answer is no. And we say that in jest. Okay. We do say that in jest. What do I think of timber framing as something that's sustainable for a guy who wants to get after it? I think it's there. I do think it's there. So, quick history of American timber framing. So in the late 60s, early 70s, these guys in New England kind of really resurrected this craft from the revolutionary days of our country. if you back up to the New World and, you know, folks coming over from Europe and religious freedom and all of that kind of stuff, you had this melting pot of these different nationalities that came to America. And the interesting thing is they brought their cultural way of building timber frames with them.
Absolutely.
So you had English barns and you had French barns and you had German barns and you had Dutch barns. You had all these different styles. And then when that generation died off, timber framing really kind of died off for a while. And then in, like I said, in late 60s, early 70s, mainly guys in New England, they really kind of resurrected that craft again. Well, that group of guys, which were the industry leaders, they're either retired, some of them have passed on, or they're just not doing it. They're more teachers now than they are operators. There was another wave that came in about the turn of the century, and I was in that wave. And so a whole bunch of the main body of timber framers now, we're in our 50s. There's got to be another wave. There's got to be another wave that comes in after us because, you know, let's face it, we got 10, 15 good years in us, and then we're out. You know, somebody's got to pick it up,
right?
Or it could die off again.
Up here, there's a timber frame school, and I've met several different people that are attending it, and they're doing timber frames up here in Upper Minnesota, and they're learning how to do timber frames, and they are enjoying it, and they are definitely the younger generation.
That's good. That's good. I think the next group, it'll be interesting. Again, I sound like grumpy old guy, get off my lawn. I realize that. Generation that's coming in now into the workforce, guys in their mid-20s, they had a remarkably different childhood than I did. I don't know how many projects I built forever had a cell phone. You know, these guys can't remember when there wasn't a cell phone. And so with the way social media works and the way the internet works, they can get their advertising out quick, fast, make an impact, that kind of stuff. I think the key for those guys is twofold. A, the majority of their buyers are going to be old, grumpy, get off my lawn guys. They're not going to be, because they're the ones that have the money.
Right.
It's not going to be guys in their tax bracket, right? So you have to be able to market yourself to the tax bracket that can afford it. The second part of that is it doesn't matter how flashy your advertising is, you better build a good frame.
Reputation.
Yeah, you got to build a good frame. And what's interesting about frames is that if we put together a big tour and, you know, had, I don't know, a group of people and we're touring different timber framers' frames, and I was part of that group and some other timber framers were part of that group, but everybody else was potential consumers, let's say. The potential consumers would walk into these beautiful homes and they would go, wow, wow, look at that. That's cool. That's cool. They wouldn't see what I see. They wouldn't see what the other timber framers see. When we walk into somebody else's home, we notice style. We notice sequencing. We notice joinery decisions. We notice that kind of stuff because we see it with a different eye. Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't mean the consumers have to raise their awareness or their education to that level. That's certainly not the point that I'm trying to make. But you can tell a shoddy frame when you see it. And I have certainly walked into other frames where I went, ugh.
But the homeowner was happy.
But the homeowner was happy for a time. But once that frame dried out and their angle braces started to fall out of their pockets, they weren't happy anymore. And so there are, you got to understand who it is you're marketing to, but you also got to be good. You got to build a good frame. And if you do that, you'll do well.
I've learned a lot today, John.
Yeah, I'm waiting for the big question.
You know what? I don't know what that question is. Help me out a little.
I don't know what that question would be either. I keep thinking, okay, that's a good question. That's a good question. He's saving this big question for the end here, and I'm not sure what that question would be.
No, you've answered so much, and you know, my goal was just to explore what you do and how you do it and how you got here and to show off the blue collar work that you do. And I think we've achieved that today. And on that note, is there anything that you're thinking of that I haven't brought up that you'd like to bring up?
Yeah. So let's go down this road just for a minute. So there are different types of timber framers available to hire. Okay, so you got big ones, medium ones, small ones. And we all do things a little bit differently. So there are big timber frame companies out there that within their shop environment, they're using automated tools to cut the frames.
Okay.
So they're not typically being cut by human hands anymore. They're automated. And this is German software. They're called Hundeggers. And there's some other variations of that. Typically, that's like a seven-figure commitment to get that set up and running in your shop. I looked at that years ago and I thought, you know what? If I buy the beast, then I got to figure out how to feed the beast. Mm-hmm. And so that turns you into a volume timber framer. Nothing wrong with that, but there are groups out there that do that type of thing. And then you have the medium size, which is the category I would be in. Medium-sized timber framers, you know, their shops are anywhere from four guys to 10, that kind of range. And they're still cutting by hand, fitting by hand. Typically, the guys that cut the frames are also the guys that raise the frames. And then you have, and they're doing that in a shop location and then moving that material to the job site location. And then you have the next layer down, the smaller guys, and there may be only two or three of them. They happen to live in an area where there's lots of local type work. And so they would do all of their work on site. So they don't necessarily have a shop. They'll have a place where they can store some tools, but their shop is wherever the job is, similar to a right. stick framer. And so they would be on site for however long it took them to lay out, cut, fit, raise a frame as they go. I don't know that there's wrong or right there as much as there's just preference. Years ago, we looked at how can Clydesdale Frames Company either automate or have multiple shop locations in different parts of the country? I mean, how could we do that to capitalize? You know, after some serious soul searching, John, I realized I didn't really want to be that busy. I decided I didn't want to take over the world as a premier timber framer as much as I just like the lifestyle. I like not wearing a suit to work. I like the fact that I love all the guys that work for me. I love the fact that we have a big shop, and I love the fact that we get to travel around and do this. The money is enough that we can all make our mortgage payments, send our kids to school. It's a good lifestyle. I didn't need to be Bill Gates at it. And so I don't know if I was halfway through my 30s when I realized that or into my 40s where I thought, you know what, I don't need to take over the world. I'm happy with the lifestyle. And so we stopped looking at ways to get bigger.
Mm-hmm. And that's great. I love that.
Yeah. So from a consumer standpoint, you may 100% be in a market where you just want to do all your plans in one place, turn over all construction decisions to one place and let them go do their thing. And they hand you the keys when they're done. There are timber frame places that can do that. And then you have our group guys on our site. We're just timber framers. There's going to have to be a general contractor. You're going to need an outside designer to pull foundation drawings and all of that kind of stuff together. And then there's the smaller group where they really work more in the old school method of they're going to build one or two frames a year, and that's it because they're building it on site. And I don't think any of those choices are wrong, but they all fit people's preferences, time expectations, budgetary. There's somebody for everybody there.
Have you formed relationships with various contractors that understand the timber frame and can work well with you?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. So the longer you're in business, obviously, that happens. And the thing about timber frame, so when you drive by a construction site, and I know you've seen this 1,000 times, there's usually a sign out in the yard that says Dave King Construction or whatever like that on it.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have any of those signs because my sign is that timber standing there.
Mm-hmm.
The parade typically starts after we leave. We may be on a job site for 2 or 3 days and that's it. You know, and that frame's there in the air, big blue sky around it, beautiful, that kind of thing. And then we're down the road back to the shop to do the next one. It takes a little while for word to travel through the community or through the city or through wherever it is that you are. But I have general contractors calling me time and time again. man, you didn't tell me there'd be people stopping in here all hours of the day asking questions. And I'm like, well, yeah, I didn't want to tell you that because I didn't want to, you know, scare you. He goes, you should have left me some business cards. I said, just tell him my name. Clydesdale Frames Company. Look at them on the internet. There's only one of us. Mm-hmm. You don't have a lot of repeat customers, but you do have repeat general contractors. And so somebody in that area where the general contractor is working, all of a sudden he's got somebody else saying, man, I'd love to have one of those. Well, that GC probably only knows one timber framer, and that's you.
Right.
Next thing you know, you're doing another one there. And so that has happened frequently over the years.
That is way cool because obviously you did the kind of work that he trusts and he likes and he recommends, and that pipeline just keeps working.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So how far, and you mentioned travel, how far around do you go? How far have you gone? What are some cool places that you've built some of these?
Okay, so, you know, we're here in Kansas. We have a frame in Minnesota, Virginia, Montana, Arizona, Texas, and then all kind of points in between with the New Mexico and the Colorado and the Wyomings and Nebraska and Iowa and all your Midwest states. Haven't gone into the Southeast much. I got one coming up in Kentucky at some point here, probably next year. We have a big map in our shop, and I have a 12-hour circle that's kind of drawn around Hutchinson, Kansas. And we've been outside of that 12-hour circle a couple times. And honestly, it kind of depends on how hungry I am. Mm-hmm. And so I don't pursue work. I get emails all the time, like from California and New York, and I don't pursue any of that stuff. When we were 20-something, it was really cool to hit the road. Mm-hmm. Now that we're 50-something, you know, kids are in ball games and, you know, there's church programs and whatever else is going on. I mean, you don't want to travel if you don't have, if you could do the job an hour away or 10 hours away, you do it an hour away. We've gotten more popular, you know, within 2 hours of our location now than we were 20 years ago. And so it's nice to stay closer to home. And I don't do the trade shows anymore. I haven't been to a trade show in 5 years, probably. We get all of our work, word of mouth through architects, engineers. And if it feels a little slow, I have a TV commercial that airs in Kansas. We run it for about 3 months and the phones start ringing. You know, we're okay with that. You still venture outside the state, but not as far as we used to go. Now, I have some 20-somethings, John, that work for me. They want to go all over the place.
Of course.
Yeah. Hey, can't we do some jobs in Alaska? Like, no, I don't want to go to Alaska. I'll never come home if I go up there and see that place.
When you are going to head out somewhere, let's say you're inside your circle, but it's a long ways away. Will you load up a semi with everything you need, head out 3 or 4 days later, you're done and you head back?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. I mean, in 23 years, we've never had to spend the weekend anywhere. It may be Friday night driving home late, but we've always been able to keep it contained within a Monday to through a Friday. We'll have a shipper come in, a semi-truck, load all the timbers and everything on the truck, cover all the timber with clear plastic, and then use the shipper's tarps to tarp over the top of that. Yet we want to try to keep that timber as clean as we can as it rolls down the road. And then if there's room on the truck, we put our tool pack on with ladders and toolboxes and all that stuff. If not, those go in our pickups, and we'll have two pickups, just personal trucks. I don't have logos on the side or anything like that. And then we roll out to wherever it is we're going.
Sounds fun.
Yeah. I mean, I like being on the road. I mean, honestly, John, you get into a business because you like doing whatever that task is. I liked working with wood. I thought the chisel and the mallet were really cool. I loved the idea of building something that nobody else really builds. I loved all that stuff. And then we got busy enough, I had to start hiring people. And once you start hiring people, I don't actually do the thing that I love doing anymore. Now I just talk on the phone or answer emails or fight with engineers or explain to architects that, hey, I got to have support there. That dome isn't going to float. Things like that. I mean, so what I do for the business is not why I got in the business, but that's what you end up doing. And that's okay. I mean, that's just part of it.
Do you ever just go down and just handle a chisel and a mallet just for old time's sake?
Well, no, I don't. And the reason is, if I go work out on the floor, I'm taking hours from my guys.
Got you.
And, you know, I pay them by the hour and they have a good benefit package. And I mean, I pay retirement, I match retirement and stuff like, I mean, there isn't a whole lot of perks to a construction job. There really isn't. And so I try to build in as many perks as I possibly can, because once you train a guy to be a timber framer, you dang sure ain't going to lay him off. I mean, you don't want him to go anywhere and do anything else, because you can't hire a guy who knows how to do what he's doing.
And do it your way.
Yeah, and do it our way. I mean, so if we're slow, or sometimes we get caught in the shipping nightmare and you're waiting on a truck to come in. And so, I mean, the guys, you can't sweep the shop floor every day for a week. You got to figure out something to do. And so I've come up with some really creative things where those guys are going to get their 40 hours. We're doing something that doesn't generate any money at all, but it puts money in their pocket. And I'm happy doing that because I don't want to lose the crew.
Sure.
I don't go out there and work with them per se because of that. Now, my wife always has the honey-do list, and I know every guy out there listening to that knows what I'm talking about. And so, yeah, I can be busy in the shop doing that kind of thing, you know, making shelves for something or whatever. Yeah, typically I do not do timber framing anymore until we get on the raising.
All right. Anything else on your mind?
Go Steelers. No, I can't think of anything else. I mean, we could talk about clients and, you know, funny things all day long, but the stories are, the setup is huge. I don't know. How long have we been doing this?
Well, we've been on for an hour and 15 minutes, but I don't care. If you got a little funny story, let's hear it.
Okay. Let me think about this for a minute.
You got edit. I mean, you can sit here and, you know, we'll cut out time.
Right. There's always funny stuff that happens. Let me think about okay, I got one.
All right.
We're doing a job up in Lawrence, Kansas at one of the lakes up there. My neighbor who lives across the street from me is a body mechanic guy, older me, about 10 years older than me, but he would travel with us and do these timber. His son worked for me full time. He was the first guy I ever hired, was Pete's son. And so Pete would come with us, come do raisings. He loved it. And he was a MacGyver guy. I mean, so he could figure out anything. If the crane broke down, he could fix it, all of that kind of stuff. But Pete has a crazy, fun, clean sense of humor, and which is rare these days, right? He had a pair of glasses that he made out of Saab headlights. And so it was like this concave, I might not have the word right, but is concave where the glass rotates out like a bubble, or is that convex? I don't remember what the right term is. Whichever way it was, but he had these little headlights that were solid glass, like a bubble, and the glass was half inch thick. And he welded up like glasses around them that could go around your ear and the whole bit. And he used to keep them in the glove box of the work truck.
Okay.
So we're in Lawrence, Kansas, work all day. It's dark, you know, got to shut down now because the sun has gone down. And so we roll into town close to the hotel and walk into a sports bar to get something to eat. And Pete pulls, we're dirty from the day. Pete pulls these glasses out of the glove box and he puts them on. Now, Pete's about 5'6", 5'5". I walk into the restaurant and Pete's standing next to me with his left hand on my right shoulder like he's blind.
Well, he'd have to practically because he can't see crap through those things.
No, you can see nothing through them. And so he's blind holding on to my shoulder. And we walk into the restaurant and all the rest of the crew's walking behind us and they're rolling laughing, right? Because everybody in the place cranes their head to look at this old guy. And Pete's turning his head back and forth like he's looking at everybody. Mm-hmm. And it's like the Mr. Magoo glasses from the cartoon way back in the day, you know?
It's real big.
And so he sits down at the table. Like I pull the chair out for him and help him in like he's blind. And he sits down and the waitress is coming and he's holding the menu and the menu's upside down. And he's looking at, he doesn't realize it's upside down because he can't see it. Mm-hmm. We can realize it. So we're rolling and the waitress comes, gets, you know, our orders for water or whatever. And she looks at Pete and Pete looks up at her with the menu upside down. And he says, "Hey, what's your special? I don't see it here." And that was all the waitress could handle. That she starts laughing and then he can't handle it anymore. He takes the glasses off and, you know, we're back to being somewhat normal. But, the road is full of funny stories like that all the time. And it, you know, lots of construction crews travel together, but when you, I have a set of brothers that worked for me for 20 years. And so when you travel with family, everybody likes each other. Mm-hmm. I mean, nobody's mad. You're not digging in. It's just fun. You know, people say, "Well, you guys go out at night and party and stuff." No, man, we're tired. Mm-hmm. You work 14 hours on a job site. You go get something to eat. You go to the hotel. You take a shower. And you go to bed. You got to do the same thing the next day. And so I always told our clients, I said, "Hey, we're not here to sightsee. You know, so we're going to come here and get the job done. And if there's time left, we might go look at that neat thing over there in Wyoming or wherever in the world we were." Yeah, lots of fun stories on the road.
That's great. I like the great interaction. That's so much better than it is at some places.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It could be funny without it being vulgar and crude and hurting somebody. You know what I mean? Lots of those stories there. And it seems like I can never remember them all until I'm in the truck and we're driving 6 hours somewhere. And the next thing you know, the stories just come flooding back. All of a sudden, you just remember everything.
Well, you know, at some point we could do a follow-up. You make some notes on different stories you want to talk about. And we could literally have an episode where all you're doing is just talking about tales from the road. And I'd be more than happy to do a podcast of that. That way you'd have all your ducks in a row. You could just sit there and go through it.
Yeah, we could probably come up with some, that's for sure. All right, turn tape back on.
Tape is back on.
We're doing a job down in Texas, south of Dallas. I'm trying to remember the name of the little town. Cannot remember it. This particular frame did not have a ridge beam. What it had was a purlin on either side of the ridge. And so it created a gap up there. And we were putting in the purlins and I was standing on scaffolding. This was years ago. This was back when we used to wear superhero shirts as our raising shirts. Now, this was before the Avengers, and you know, now that's popular. At the time, people would say, why are you wearing a Superman shirt? Yeah, why are you wearing a Batman shirt or a Spider-Man shirt? And so we wore superhero shirts, and on the back of it, it just said Clydesdale Frames Company, had our phone number. And it was just silly. We just did it because it was dumb, because it was mm-hmm. funny. Mm-hmm. I had a Superman shirt on. And so I was standing on top of this scaffolding, and I put a purlin in, and then I put a purlin in on the other side of where the ridge would be. So now I had a purlin behind me and in front of me. And the homeowner, great guy, went elk hunting with him a whole bunch of different times after this. And he hollers up, "Hey man, you gonna be able to slip between those purlins?" And I say, "Hey, Superman can suck it in." And so I suck it in and start sliding down between these purlins and just about get stuck.
Oh no!
Just about get stuck between these two pieces. But I was able to wiggle through. Now, that was 21 years ago, maybe. Mm-hmm. I'm a tad heavier.
My body lost 5 pounds.
Then. Okay, I'm a lot heavier than then. And so that same phrase crops up all the time. And so we did a raising last week, and there were some stick frame walls that were on the job. Well, they're 16 inches on center, right? And so mm-hmm. I go slipping between the 16-inch center studs, and you know, it's a good thing that 2x4s bend. and so as I'm bowling my way through, I hear one of my guys that's still there from way back in the day, "Hey, looks like Superman can still suck it in." I'm like, "Yeah, you're fired. You're fired, buddy." You know.
That's funny.
Yeah. Yeah. Not lots of good. I can tell you a story about how I cut my fingers off.
What?
Oh, yeah.
Let's hear it.
All right. So we were building a bar top for a local church. They're going to build this like big coffee bar, half round or, you know, round coffee bar thing where you can get in the middle of it. I was friends with the pastor. And so we were going to build this bar top. Now, usually with a bar top, John, you know, the boards run lengthwise across the bar. But since this was more of a round thing, our boards ran the short dimension, not the long dimension. And so we had a whole bunch of one bys that were all kind of different wood species. I don't even remember how we had them or why we had them, but we had a whole pile of them. And so I was just running them through the table saw. I mean, they already cut to length at like 18 inches or something like that. And I was just running them through the table saw to get them all the same size. I think I had it set at 7 inches, something like that. Our table saw has a 7-horse motor on it.
Mm.
And the blade itself is 18 inches. I think it's an 18-inch blade. It's a monster.
This is a mill. This isn't a table saw.
Yeah, no, it's a monster. And so when people say, well, why don't you have the little thing on there where, you know, you put the hot dog in, it just stops. That doesn't work unless you have a Black and Decker little table saw. I mean, when you have these big monster things, that kind of braking system doesn't work. So I'm running these pieces through. Earlier that day, a Catholic priest friend of mine came down to the shop and he wanted to borrow my coyote trap. And you're thinking to yourself, are coyotes running around the church building? Well, why does the local Catholic priest want your coyote trap? Well, he had heard that I would do this lesson where I would talk about how you trap coyotes and how you would lure them to a hole and get them to put their foot in a particular spot and you would trap them. It was kind of a lesson on how the devil can lure you into a spot and then trap you. I mean, that's the gist of it. Well, he had heard about this and loved it and wanted to know if he could use it for a homily he had coming up. And I said, yeah, sure, I don't care. So he says, John, I've never set a coyote trap, so I don't know how to do this. And I said, well, come on down to the shop. I'll show you how to do it. So on the tailgate of my truck, I'm showing this guy how to set a coyote trap. Now, here's the thing, John. He wouldn't touch the trap.
He wouldn't?
No. He's standing next to me, and he's like filming with his phone. He's filming me do it. And I'm like, you're going to have to – I mean, I'm not coming to your service to set this for you, so you're going to have to know how to do this. And so gingerly, he sets it one time, fingers are shaking, is, you know, really, really nervous about doing this because he doesn't want to snap his fingers, which I get. It hurts when that happens.
Mm-hmm.
So he gets through it one time, and he says, hey, I'm going to practice. And I said, now listen, I said, you're going to have your robes on, right? And he said, well, yeah. And I said, so make sure when you practice, you have your robes on. I mean, the last thing you want to do is get this coyote trap caught in your robes. Because, I mean, it isn't like you're just standing there in a t-shirt and a pair of shorts like you are right now. I mean, you're going to be all dressed up. So you got to make sure. And he's like, okay, no, that's good advice. And I said, are you nervous? He goes, yeah, I am. And I said, you'll be fine. So he takes the stuff and leaves. And I go in and I'm cutting stuff on the table saw. And about 30, 40 minutes later, I have a piece that I'm sliding through and it starts to kick. Now, when a piece kicks, it's going to come back and hit you right in the mouth. And so I'm sliding it through with my right hand. And so I just try to put some weight, you know, down on that piece so it wouldn't kick and hit me in the face. And it kicks. I'm not even sure what happens because it happens in a blink of an eye. But my hand rolls through that blade.
Oh, my God.
And I knew it got me. And so what's the first thing you do when you have that kind of thing? You take your hand and you wrap it up in the bottom of your t-shirt.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why t-shirts are so comforting, but for some reason they are. And I wrapped it up and kicked the saw off. And of course it made an awful sound and everybody in the shop looks. I'm like, it got me. And I said, somebody go call 911. I walked out of the shop doors and sat down in the shade against the building just to try to, you know how you're, when you get hurt like that, your body's trying to do like that system check.
Yeah.
What's wrong? What is it wrong? What parts are working? What parts are not working?
Was it hurting yet?
No. I mean, yes, it hurt, but it wasn't like screaming agony, weeping. It wasn't that kind of thing. I'm sitting there and one of my employees comes by and goes, okay, I called 911, ambulance is on the way. He goes, let me see. And I said, no. And by that time, I could tell that I still had a thumb, but I couldn't tell what else I had.
And you didn't want to look?
No, I don't want to look. You could see the blood. I mean, my shirt was caked at that point. And so ambulance shows up. I get in. And of course, this is my right hand. So they're like, can you sign? Can we just go? Can we just go? And I'll put an X on there with my left hand on the way. You know, I mean, let's just go. I get to the ER. One of my employees called my wife. And so she's on her way over there. In ERs, you're used to seeing the same thing. I mean, if you're working in an ER, I mean, you're used to seeing the same kind of emergencies come in and come in. But when the paramedics radio, hey, we're bringing in a guy who probably cut off all his fingers on a table saw, that means anybody who isn't otherwise assigned is waiting for you to walk in the door because they're about to see something they haven't seen yet.
And you've got a gut that looks like it's been bleeding.
Oh, yeah. You know, so I come in and it's like a circus of doctors and nurses and people in scrubs and all of that. I mean, I was getting like the best care you could possibly get, you know. And so when they started to unwrap my hand, that's the first time that I could actually see what was going on. I lost a half inch off of my pinky finger. My ring finger was cut at the bottom, right at the base of the hand. It's basically was gone. I mean, it was still there because it was in my shirt, but it wasn't attached anymore. Mm-hmm. My middle finger was chewed up on the underside of it, and my pointy finger was chewed up on the top side of it because the hand kind of rolled through the blade, and my thumb was good. There's a hand surgeon in Denver. There's a hand surgeon in Wichita, but he can't take anybody today. And so now they're taking videos and films and sending it. Are we getting on a plane? Or what are we doing? And so by that time, you know, half of my circle knows what's going on and people are just showing up. Really good friend of mine, pastor guy, not the priest, but pastor friend of mine, he shows up and he's standing next to me. And he's like, oh, dude, that's gnarly. Can I take a picture of that? I'm like, man, get away from me. I said, no, you're not putting this on Facebook. You know, this isn't for public consumption. You know, your best friends in the world are the ones that will laugh at you when you fall, but they will help you up, you know. And so all of this is going on. And then the most painful part of it, John, was they had to numb the area. And so they started sticking needles in the ends of my fingers.
But there was no feeling.
But
the new end or the old end?
in some cases, it was the raw end.
Okay.
You know, and that hurt like nobody's business.
Really?
Oh, my gosh. That hurt worse than the saw hurt.
Wow.
And so, but they're trying to numb it. Well, at this point, my youngest son, who's seventh grade at the time, he's a freshman in college now. He comes in and he's seen all of this, and I can see the look on his face. And I said, his name's Bo. And I said, Bo, love you, man. I said, I'll be okay. I'll be okay. Why don't you wait out in the waiting room while they do this nasty part? And he did. And he did. And there were some guys out there, you know, friends of the family, that kind of thing. And they were able to corral him, love up on him, you know, that kind of stuff. So then there's kind of a lull in the action while they're waiting to figure out what specialist I'm going to go to. And I tell my wife, I said, hey, I said, grab my phone. And so she grabs my phone and gives it to me. And I call my Catholic priest friend.
Oh.
And I said, hey, you remember today when you said that you were nervous about, you know, getting your fingers caught in that trap and how bad that might hurt? And he said, yeah. And I said, well, don't worry about it. It's going to be good because I've interceded on your behalf and I have given my fingers in sacrifice to your sermon tomorrow or Sunday. And he said, what are you talking about? And so I told him what happened. He couldn't believe it. He was like, I'm on my way. I said, no, there's enough clergy here already. We don't need any more. I said, we're fine. So the funny part of the story for me from like a religious standpoint is, you know, a Catholic priest intercedes for. And so I felt like I got to do my part here. I interceded for him so that he could do his sermon and not worry about his fingers, which he did. And he only messed up one time from what I heard. And the trap jumped off of the podium that he would, like the spring snapped and he wasn't ready for it. Mm-hmm. And it popped off of the podium and rolled down toward the audience. And folks were bailing out of the first row thinking this thing was going to grab them like a piranha or something. And I thought I would have loved to have seen that.
Mm-hmm.
So that was, what, 5 years ago?
Jeez.
That was about 5 years ago that happened. And so there are things that I, you know, timber framing wise, I don't climb anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Because I can't. I mean, I can't hold on to the timber, you know, and steady myself when you're like pulling yourself up from one purlin to another or something like that.
Right.
You know, so you're handicapped in the true sense of the word because it's your hand. And there's things that you just can't do anymore. The most painful thing I do is write checks. and I say that metaphorically, but I also say that physically. To scrimp up my fingers and hold on to a pen is very difficult. Dude, I can't make a fist.
Mm-mm-mm.
And so, yeah, no, it can be. I had to learn how to do a lot of things left-handed.
Well, you could learn how to write left-handed.
I did for a while. And my signature, if you look at my signature pre-accident and now, it's similar, but it's a lot sloppier now than it was.
I can imagine.
But
oh man,
there's a lot of nine-finger carpenters walking around that are old guys.
Yeah. Well, that is truly, in some ways, horrifying.
Yeah, I don't know if that's a story for a podcast or not. It's just a good story.
Well, and if you don't have any problems with it, we'll keep it in.
Right, don't bother me any.
All right. Yeah. It's life, right?
Yeah. It's like, I mean, you might have to ask me a question, that you would put in front of it, something to the effect of, so John, you've been doing this for 23 years. You know, a lot of carpenters get banged up. I mean, it's a hard life. Have you ever been nicked up? There you go.
Wow. I have a feeling you got a whole bunch more stories.
I got lots of stories.
We need to, at some point, you make some notes and we'll have a story time.
Okay.
But for now, John, I have really enjoyed having you on the podcast and talking to you. Good times, man. And appreciate you sharing your life.
Hey, I appreciate it. Thanks for, I don't know how you got a hold of me. I don't know how that happened, but yeah, it's been fun.
Well, I'm going to let you go here, and thank you very much. And, John, take care.
Take care, John. I appreciate it.
Today's trivia question is, how long did it take to build the Hoover Dam? The next guest on the Blue Collar Voices show is Jason, also known as Jay, Bergfield. Jay specializes in doors and trim and started experiencing woodcraft at a young age, tagging along with his father. Here is a little snippet from the show with Jay.
At first, the plumbing stuff, those kind of phone calls, it's weird. I was getting those phone calls, but it didn't take long for maybe word to spread. That guy doesn't do plumbing electrical. Those calls stopped coming in. As Jay's handyman service, those type of leads faded away. I started getting a reputation of doing finish work. Hey, this guy's really good at finish carpentry. So recommendations are huge. Word of mouth is huge.
Thank you, everyone, for listening to this episode of the Blue Collar Voices show. On this episode's page on bluecollarvoices.com, you will find show notes and any relevant links. If you are not subscribed to get notifications of new show episodes, you can do that at bluecollarvoices.com as well. Hey, let me know what you think.
I'd love to hear from you. See you next time.
I'll be back.